Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
If you love eating eggs like I do, you are happy to hear that after over 30 years in the nutrition penalty box for cholesterol, eggs were finally given a reprieve, and science now says, yes, there is cholesterol in eggs, but for most people, eating foods with cholesterol in them doesn't necessarily have a relationship with the cholesterol levels in our bodies. So now, even cautious and careful dietitians now say people can go ahead and enjoy eggs, maybe daily. So now we can be guilt-free in enjoying our eggs again, and some often exotic breeds of chickens are showing up in upscale neighborhoods and their backyards across the country, and for the rest of us who don't have chickens in our backyards, there are more and more questions, particularly how are those eggs produced? In small cages or no cages? With antibiotics or without antibiotics? By small farms or large industrial-style farms? Will small farms be able to compete without the advantages of large scale? To help us figure all of this out, we're going to a New Hampshire-based free-range organic egg farm, Pete and Jerry's, to speak to the farmer, Jesse LaFlamme. Jesse, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Jesse, you're a fourth-generation farmer, but there's a lot of other ways you could be making a living. Why are you raising hens and producing eggs?
a lot of reasons I came back to the family farm, actually, and one of them I have to say is that I really like hens. I really like chickens and being around them. I think they're just so much fun to watch. They're absolutely hilarious, kind of ridiculous animals in their own world. My first pet was actually a hen. Her name was Nellie. So it's sort of natural for me to want to be on the farm and be around the hens. But probably the leading reason for coming back to the family farm and family business right after college, the day after college, was the sort of opportunity that I saw in our transformation, an opportunity to grow the farm the right way, to grow a business and really kind of change the way eggs are produced into the future, we hope.
Well, you've already said a lot of things I want to circle back on. One is I never knew hens were fun. You're the first person I think I've ever heard say that the hens are fun. But I can't imagine. I mean, you can't throw a ball and have them retrieve it or anything. But so you kind of got people thinking, I think, right there that there's another whole venture there that they may need to be looking at instead of that. Instead of a dog, maybe they should get their family hen.
I think they should. Anytime you can have a backyard flock, I think somebody should. It's they will actually. Some hens will come and greet you when they see you. Mm-hmm. Now it's a question that they might be interested in whether you have some grain or something for them. But they're so curious and I find that they have personalities. Especially when you have them in smaller groups, and you can really see it, and we see it with our free range hens. Just their behaviors. You have what I describe as the type A personalities that always have somewhere to go and something to do. So as soon as the doors open in the barns, later in the morning, they typically make a beeline to go outside and go on the day's adventure or some kind of exploring. And then you have your more timid hens who will kind of hang back and maybe want to roost for most of the day. And then you have your hens that are really just interested in hanging out in the nest for as long as they possibly can. So we have a variety of personalities.
Well, like somebody pointed out to me, though, with any animals, if you're going to have them in close quarters, you got to remember that you not only have to feed and water them, but you have to clean up after them. So there are chores to go with deciding to have some livestock close at hand. But let's go to kind of the reality of your production system, because you were saying that when you looked at this, it was a chance to come back and raise hens and produce eggs like they should be done, like it should be done. How do you determine that? When you started looking ahead and your farms have looked ahead, what have you come to and saying, here is the production system that we think is the most correct way to be producing hens and growing eggs, or growing hens and producing eggs?
Sure. So there's certainly today just an incredibly wide variety of how eggs are produced. And the most prevalent method, currently about 90% of hens are kept this way, is in battery cages. So anyone who's not familiar with battery cages, hens that are really in a small wire enclosure, typically about 9 hens in the volume of, say, an average microwave oven, to give people an idea of the space. And some of these cages are so small that not all the hens can actually stand up at the same time, so some of them sort of back where they can't stand. And it's, frankly, it's not a very pleasant environment by most people's sort of objective standards of living conditions for any kind of animal. And, in addition to the conditions in a battery cage, it's the size that typically goes along with a typical egg farm and egg production. It's not uncommon today to have 250,000 to 500,000 hens in battery cages in a single barn, and that's typically one barn of many that are very close to one another. So we're talking about millions of hens on a single location and a single farm, a very industrial setting. And I think, as a society, and certainly the leaders in grocery and even restaurant chains and so forth, are looking at these conditions and deciding, we can do something better. And that's where a lot of these declarations to, become cage-free or to sell only cage-free, most of them are by 2025. That's where this has really come from. So it's a huge step in the right direction to only source cage-free eggs. But the reality is we have a very consolidated egg industry in the U.S. There's less than 200 egg farms or egg businesses selling eggs. One way to compare that, I guess, would be to dairy farms, where there's close to 50,000 in the U.S. So these egg businesses are typically, processing and marketing and distribution, as well as the farm itself. So they range anywhere from, a million hens to the largest egg company in the country has 38 million hens. And those 38 million are not all in one place, but a very large scale. So, the idea is how can we possibly produce all these eggs in a humane fashion for the entire nation's consumption.
Well, I'm going to back.
That's where cage-free comes in.
Yeah. Well, let me back you up just a second there, because, first of all, battery sometimes throws people. They're not used to that term. What does that mean, battery cages?
Sure. So it's really referring to just a continuous length of these cages, continuous row. So at the front of a egg production building, you'll really look down at it, and they may be between 400 and, as long as 600 feet long. Mm-hmm. And it's just one cage after another. So in the industry, it's described as a battery cage, one after another.
Okay. Because I, a lot of people hear that, and I think they don't want to seem stupid, so they don't ask.
I should know
what battery cage means. But now, the other thing I'm wondering about, Jesse, there was a point that they didn't have all these cages. I mean, when I grew up, all the farmers all had a flock of chickens and had to go out to the chicken yard and, had eggs, and they had other livestock as well as chickens. And then somewhere in there, 30, 40 years ago or so, these larger scale operations started taking place. And I don't know if there's any magic moment that you know of from the history that where they started, here's a model. All we have to do is get a million chickens and put them in very small cages, and we can make more money, and probably it'll end up putting people out of business that are smaller scale, that simplifying that process. But there was some period, was it 25, 30 years ago or so, that there was this big explosion towards this more industrial style of egg production?
Yeah, it was probably shortly after World War II. And I think it was kind of born out of specialization in agriculture that started to occur post-World War II. And some of that was from just sort of selective breeding that had happened in the poultry industry. My grandfather, who produced eggs, of course, very early on, post-World War II, his earliest hens were good egg layers compared to our great egg layers, but they were also really kind of heavy, what were called heavy birds. So they would go on to become chicken dinner on somebody's table. Whereas now you sort of have the egg side of the business, and you have the meat side of the business with Tyson's and Purdue's of the world, and it's really a completely different hen. So I think that specialization and focus on egg production was a huge part of it. Of course, you got away from sort of the diversified farms that you described, where just like my great grandfather, great grandparents were, the hens running around the farm were sort of referred to as the grocery money. You bring in the eggs to the town nearby once a week, and that was and exchange them for groceries or a little extra spending money. But now, post World War II, farmers specialized in egg production, and that eventually, led to larger and larger scale. I think it was probably around the early '60s, I believe, when the first cages were introduced. And some of it was certainly a reaction to efficiency, but it was also at that time a reaction to trying to prevent illnesses and disease challenges that might face hens roaming around outside or inside a barn. And I'll circle back on that, but many of those things that we've dealt with since those days through vaccines and other husbandry methods.
Well, that's a good point. And something else you said a few minutes ago I wanted to circle back to, and that is when retailers and restaurants have started to say, we want to have our eggs produced differently. Was that motivated by consumers complaining or asking questions? I'm kind of wondering, I'm trying to avoid saying which came first, the chicken or the egg here, but... but still, it seems like it's a fair question. Is what motivated this change, is saying that we're looking for more and more production that's not in these small cages?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of consumers, activists, and even to some degree sort of global developed world trends happening. And I think McDonald's is a good example of that, where their CEO, who obviously had a huge hand in making the decision for McDonald's to commit to cage-free eggs in the future, actually came from the UK, where McDonald's over there has been serving actually free-range eggs, I think for close to a decade now. So certainly consumers are just more and more interested in where their food comes from. We see that's just an ongoing trend that's really allowed for our existence and our family farm's existence. Consumers want to know where their food comes from, and they want to feel good about where it comes from. So they're starting to ask questions. So they ask questions of the restaurant chains and the retailers that they're shopping and eating with, a huge part of it. And, of course, that consumer awareness in no small part is driven by, the activist groups. And they run the gamut of extreme productive and helpful in a lot of ways, entering into dialogue and not necessarily being hostile to agriculture. They've really kind of forwarded the dialogue that, hey, there's a better way to do things that won't entirely upset agriculture in this country. We just need to progress.
I know there's a lot of other things to talk about here other than cages, but I want to still start back with the cage, because it seems like there's this reaction at first saying that we believe that hens should have more room. Now, I'm oversimplifying, but the way that happens, it can be bigger cages, it can be, cage-free, which isn't necessarily free-range, which doesn't necessarily mean it goes outside, or pasture-raised. There's a lot of terminology. It seems like there's a broad range of, is it just bigger cages? Is it just being loose inside, or is it just being in the pasture? And I'm sure I butchered that explanation, Jesse, but is that kind of the spectrum of doing something better than the small cages?
Yeah, I think you've got it, actually. So in Europe, since 2012, they've actually banned battery cages throughout the EU. And their idea at the time for replacement of those battery cages was something called enriched cages. And it's a much larger cage with a larger population of hens, but each hen has more space and can move around first and foremost. And there's actually a little privacy curtain inside for egg laying and a tiny little surface to kind of scratch on and some perching areas. So the idea is to give the hens a little bit more natural or the ability to exercise natural behavior. So I think that's probably the first and foremost point of any progression in animal welfare for livestock, for animal agriculture in this country is, you know, can the animal exercise their natural, you know, instinctive behaviors? I personally think that's so critical, no matter what type of livestock it is. I mean, these, you know, hens aren't complicated. They just have these, you know, very basic desires to scratch, you know, to roost and to lay an egg in a private place. You know, beyond that, it's just making their lives better, you know, better scratching, being outdoors in the sun and so forth. But the enriched cage that Europe adopted allowed those most basic behaviors rather than keeping the hen almost clamped down in one little space in the battery cages. So the next, you know, the next level, which I think Europe will actually go to soon, along with the U.S., is cage-free. And cage-free is sort of like taking those larger enriched cages, but actually taking the cage doors off. So they're essentially platforms, is what cage-free has turned into, buildings with very large platforms called aviary systems, and they can be multiple levels, actually multiple levels of platforms, like two stories in a barn, and they're able to get sometimes several hundred thousand hens. The largest that I've heard so far is about 380,000 hens in a cage-free barn. So it is an improvement in welfare conditions. The hens can sort of fly around a little bit and jump back and forth, but it is a very large industrial scale. The hens never see the light of day. They never see natural light. They're always inside the barn. And from a, you know, consumer perception perspective, it really does look, as I described it, sort of a caged house or an enriched cage house without the cage doors. So it's certainly better, but in terms of consumers that are really engaged in you know, agriculture production and what, you know, have an idea of what ideal conditions should look like, it probably doesn't meet their expectations.
Well, and in fact, you look in some of the pictures of those barns, and they look fairly crowded. I have no way of judging whether a chicken has enough room or not myself, but I can see that some of them seem like they might be in a big open barn, but it's pretty tight too. Are there any restrictions to call yourself cage-free of what the density would be in a barn like that?
Unfortunately, right now there is not. You know, and I think it would be a great space for the government to really kind of define what it means and what the density is. So without a certification, without the eggs being produced under a third-party, you know, sort of animal welfare certification program, there is no stocking density, which opens up, you know, potential issues where a humane and, you know, humane or improved humane environment is no longer so humane because you have so many hens in that space. Definitely a challenge, I think, for the industry ahead. And one of the issues that we've seen with some of these aviary systems is that they actually they allow the hens to move within the platforms, but they put cage sort of wires along the upper levels, so the hens have to figure out how to kind of work their way through a maze and then get to the bottom level, and then there's a hinged door on an actuator that the producer opens up at their discretion. And it's the idea is to sort of lock the hens into the aviary, into the big cage, to train them to the nest or train them to food and water, but then let them out to get to the floor and walk around. Well, as you can imagine, this is sort of rife for abuse. If the doors never get opened up, the hens are, you know, sort of tightly kept in this giant cage. And again, it's very much what people, consumers, do not imagine when they hear the term cage-free right now.
I just heard Temple Grandin, and she was talking about the natural behavior of animals. And she was saying that one of the problems in these large industrial systems, she called them very fragile. I've never heard it referred to that way. But it was that it just requires nearly perfect management to try to not have issues when you start working on those kind of that kind of scale. But you actually, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think she's actually spot on. And what's sort of fascinating about what's happening in our industry right now, by taking the animals out of the cages, there's an entire sort of knowledge base that frankly largely doesn't exist anymore, at least on these large industrial farms, and that's through the natural behaviors of the hens. If you can imagine this, I mean, they were stuck where they were put in that cage, and you don't really have to worry about, you know, necessarily the hen so much, as long as they're not sick or overheating, or, you know, you just have to worry about the machine around them. Essentially, is you have to make sure they have grain in front of them and water above them to drink, and that's it. You know, now take the cage doors off and let the hens move around, and all of a sudden you have to worry about, you know, animal husbandry and behaviors in a very different way, and that can mean, you know, hens crowding to one end of the building because they get scared, or they're, you know, it's too cold at one end, so they'll move to another end, or, you know, they don't like the light and they don't like this nest and so forth. So it's all these factors that didn't need consideration before, and I think that really does make these systems fragile. And you know, when you're talking about a barn at such a large scale, and the people that, you know, are maybe willing or not willing to work in that barn, you're asking a lot of somebody without a lot of experience, or, you know, perhaps arguably a lot of interest in the hens they're taking care of.
Well, Temple gets back into saying that this requires us to be stockmen, that farmers know their livestock and can read what's going on with their livestock. And it probably has implications, too, in scale. I mean, it's hard for any good farmer, livestock person to read them if they've got 2 million, you know, the units, breaking into units for management's size, scalability, that you can get bigger, but there may be some point that you don't want to get that much bigger and still expect that you can be attuned to these unique expressions that you're getting from the animals.
No, that's another great point that I would agree with. And interestingly, I consider, you know, we have a handful of family farms that we partner with who were former dairy farmers, and literally it didn't achieve the scale on their conventional dairy farm to make it.
Yeah.
Eventually, you know, went out of business, but had enough capital, fortunately, left to convert the farm to egg production with us. And these dairy farmers, in my opinion, are really some of the best egg farmers that we work with, and I attribute it to that stockmanship. That they, I mean, it can be overwhelming even with the number of hens that we deal with, which is much, much less, but, you know, to look into a barn and see all these hens, you can sort of, you know, it's hard to see the trees in the forest sometimes, and you know, these dairymen, I believe, really come from a perspective where they know, you know, they knew their cows so well, especially on these smaller farms, you know, 60 to 80 head, that when they, you know, they're going through their free range barn, and they're really looking for the individuals, and they want to look for the signs, and they know, you know, they know when something's not right. All those things that I was talking about, whether it's temperature or light or something that spooked the hens, you know, they're really looking for that. Not so much just in the flock entirely, but they're looking at the, you know, looking at the individual hens. So I really do agree with her point on that.
Well, let's go to the very next stage. Now we've determined, you know, a better way of looking at the hens and how they're doing and getting them out of the cages, but now getting them out of the barns, opening the doors, getting into free range. Let's talk about that transition, because you've done that. How do you describe these systems right now? Because there have been some terminology. Some people say free range, some say pasture raised. How do you best describe the system of letting the hens go outside now?
Sure. So we are actually a part of a third-party certifier, animal welfare certifier, called Humane Farm Animal Care. And Certified Humane is their sort of consumer-facing brand and logo. So they have standards specifically for free range, and that's the largest part of our production, and our brands are free range under their certification. So what it really means for us is that the hens are not in these aviary systems, and that's kind of first and foremost, because with the aviaries, we see it as sort of a confusing, chaotic system where the hens who happen to be on the top levels of it, you know, are really probably quite unlikely to ever make it down and then find a door to go out. So the non-aviaries or single level sort of traditional hen houses and systems that we use would be recognizable to really kind of any consumer. They'd see nesting boxes, they'd see grain, you know, feed trough and watering systems and slats, and you know, they'd be able to walk around and feel comfortable and not have, you know, all this apparatus up around them and above their heads. Feels more comfortable, and I think it feels more comfortable for the hens as well, and it allows them to, you know, allows the hens to sort of see the openings to the outside and know that they can get to it and make the choice as to whether they want to go out and when, and not have to fight, you know, an enormous crowd or go through levels to get there. And free range is in the hens being able to get outside in the sunlight on vegetated ground. Again, those type A personalities I was talking about before, you know, wait by the doors for them to open, which is typically before noon. We try to keep them in during the first part of the day just to make sure that they all lay their eggs in their nests. And then we open the doors, and those type A's run out. And it's a fenced-in area near the barn, or around the barn, essentially. And we actually try to and have to, per the Certified Humane Standards, have shade structures out in front of the barns, and that allows the hens to get out of direct sunlight if they choose without having to go back inside, and also gives them a sense of safety from aerial predators, something that's very important. Temple would probably say that they're, you know, they're able to feel secure because they know they can get under something quickly while they're outside. So it's a very, very, very different environment and very different scale than you would see in one of these large cage-free aviary systems.
So you can have hawks or something, or in other parts of the country, coyotes are an issue, that somehow they were able to get into the fields, into the pastures and pens and so forth. So are there usually people around that you're seeing the hens while they're outside?
Typically, yeah, and most of our farmers, in the barns, and our team, you know, like on our home farm here, in and around the barns all day. So that's certainly a huge help. But it in terms of predators that might come from the ground, it really is important to build good fences for the hens and keep everything out just to protect them. So that's definitely key. And we've been able to, you know, really kind of avoid any major issues with predators. Aerial predators generally haven't been a huge issue for us and our farmers, but I will say that I know a farm in the Pacific Northwest with free range hens who had a bald eagle plucking hens periodically. So they actually had to enlist the help of USDA, a wildlife official, to scare the eagle away, which I think they ended up doing successfully. So it's again one of the challenges that we have to deal with letting the hens outside. But I think, you know, from a consumer perspective and from, you know, the welfare of the hens, it's one of those trade-offs that's worthwhile.
Well, you said that you have sunshades, so if the sun's and it's very, very hot, they can get in and have shade and the other protection that they can run in under these shades. What about in the middle of the winter? You get snow up there in New Hampshire. I'm sure some chickens are saying, I don't want to go out there. It's too darn cold today.
No, there's no question. Sometimes the snow is too deep. You know, we'll keep them out and let them go out as long as we possibly can. But you know, there comes a time where it's just not, well, one, they don't really want to go outside, and two, it's, even if they did, it wouldn't be the best thing for them. And it's an interesting, interesting part of the cycle of the year for the hens, and the same thing really does kind of happen with any type of free range or pasture raised production in the south or southern part of the country, southwest. So it gets so hot that the hens really have no interest in going outside. So they have the opposite but similar issue during the summers.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do for our hens during the winter months when they can't get out, really, you know, the design of the house is so important. Again, you want to keep those Type A personalities busy. Not the least reason that they're distracted and maybe not bullying their neighbors, and that really comes with, you know, adequate perching space, roosting space. But the big thing is a scratch space and what you have in that scratch space. The outside of the barns has a wide area, typically with sawdust, shavings, you know, some substance like that the hens can scratch and dig around in, and that's, you know, one of their strongest natural behaviors. What they love to do all day is just scratch around. And of course, they're looking for forage and looking for food. It's such a strong instinct for them. So we give them that area for the winter, and we've now started actually baling hay, organic hay, that's an organic flock, and suspending it from the ceiling using a nylon web, basically, that suspends the bale, and the hens, they just absolutely love that. They'll spend the entire day just pecking grass, pulling out hay from the bale, just trying to replicate that environment that they might have during the summer.
I've never seen
summer
that.
Months as much as possible inside.
You know, Jesse, back when we started this conversation, you were pointing out when that transition was made going into barns from, you know, the typical kind of chicken yard that people might have had in the smaller farms of years ago. But part of the issue was disease control. And you made some reference that's not as big a concern today. Why isn't that? I mean, if disease and those sorts of issues of having chickens outside was a problem years past, why isn't it as much of a problem today?
Sure. And, you know, and I don't want to minimize that it's, you know, that it's not or can't be an issue at all today. That would be, you know, that wouldn't be truthful. You know, any poultry disease is still around, and we haven't found the, you know, way to deal with it entirely. Obviously, with the bird flu that struck a couple of years ago demonstrated that. But there are so many issues that my grandfather used to deal with and great-grandfather used to deal with that we aren't facing anymore. And, you know, diseases from, you know, something called Marek's disease, which is a sort of neurological disorder that the hens can have, which is very catastrophic to flocks. We're able to vaccinate for that now. Bronchitis is actually, a lot of people probably don't know this, but hens get bronchitis pretty easily and pretty often, and it's something that, you know, typically isn't catastrophic, but it can really affect egg production and the quality of eggs. If anybody's bought an egg and it happens to have almost like a flat spot in the shell, you know, that's probably a hen that is suffering from bronchitis. But we, as, you know, I say the larger poultry industry has, you know, developed vaccines that treat so many of these diseases and so many of these issues, major to minor, that it's not like it used to be at all. You know, we're able to let the hens outside and know that they're going to be, you know, healthy and that there won't be major issues. You know, the other thing that I think plays into this as well is farm scale, and I know it's a, you know, controversial for some people, but I think farm scale, you know, plays a major role in the prevalence of disease. I know, you know, with these larger complexes where the barns are built, you know, right next to each other, one of the biggest issues that they face from disease is you know, one barn actually sending the disease through the air to the next barn and so forth, and all of the different age groups, you know, will sort of trade illnesses back and forth depending on, you know, how healthy or, you know, the hens are, how strong the vaccine happens to be within them. And we're dealing with family farms who are really kind of operating in isolation. So they're not facing those challenges from their, you know, multi-age peers that a very large industrial farm would see. So again, you, in my opinion, you have a much healthier hen who's able to go outside and withstand, you know, more of the challenges that might be out there as well as inside. I think it's just a healthier environment because of the scale.
What role does antibiotics play?
Sure. So antibiotics in our world don't exist. And we're able to achieve that through these vaccines, these really, you know, sort of miracle vaccines. You know, we don't want to use antibiotics. Our consumers do not want us to use antibiotics. And if we do things right, we don't have to use antibiotics. It's, again, back to the farms being smaller scale and sort of being in isolation. You know, they're not contracting diseases from older hens or illnesses from older hens. So that makes a huge difference. And if we're able to anticipate the most likely illnesses that the hens might have, even if we have to spend a little more on vaccine, you know, preventative, we can avoid using antibiotics.
You know, we've almost reconstructed the definition of organic, and you market your eggs as organic eggs. One thing, you know, you've the animal welfare issues, the you've also gotten into a little bit more on the medication issues. But to be organic, you also need to use organic feed, isn't that right?
Correct, yeah.
Isn't that hard? Is that hard to find all the feed that you need that's organic?
It is, although it's becoming a little bit easier, but particularly early on, it was incredibly difficult to get feed. In fact, at one point, my father, Jerry, was having feed delivered to New Hampshire from Pennsylvania just so he could get organic feed. It was the only place that happened to be manufacturing it. So it's, you know, that supply chain is certainly a challenge, but at least up here where we are, there's a fair amount of production upstate New York and even some in Vermont, and Quebec has been a major grower of organic grains, you know, over the last decade or so. It's grown tremendously. So you know, the supply chain in general is growing, and the means to move it around and the sources globally are growing. So at this point, knock on wood, you know, the growth seems to be keeping up. But I think, you know, we would hope and would like to see more grain produced domestically. And there's, you know, there are projects where that is, you know, being developed. Northern Maine, there's a OTA, Organic Trade Association group that's trying to work with Northern Maine former potato growers to grow organic grains now. So I think, you know, I think the future in the supply is going to be strong.
But I would imagine you still have to pay more than for conventional grain. Would that be a good guess on my part?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it's typically at least twice as much for organic grain.
You know, and people ask, why does it seem that so often organic products are more expensive? There's a lot of things that factor into it. They aren't always more expensive, but certainly when you're still dealing with having to input costs that are quite a bit higher, you would expect you have to recover it somewhere.
Right. Yeah, it's a challenge with some consumers, and particularly with the egg segment, where 90% of egg production is in these very industrial factory battery cage farms. You know, our type of production and our scale is so different than that when compared to, say, you know, most organic milk production in the country. I won't say all, because there are some very large organic dairy farms, but most dairy farms are on a smaller scale, but their systems and how the farm kind of looks is really very similar to a conventional dairy. You know, it may just be smaller, but we're sort of reinventing the wheel or changing anyway. We're sort of throwing back because the hens being out of cages and not being on such an industrial scale. So that cost is even higher because of our different systems.
You know, I understand that they continue to take a look at the organic rules, and they are continuing, I think, into this current year, they're studying other changes in guidelines that I think may have implications for rules regarding how hens are produced or chickens are produced. Do I have that right, that there are changes being considered in these organic rules on production?
Yes. Yeah, there are. There's actually the organic OLPP. So it's, I'm going to butcher what this is, but it's the Organic Livestock Poultry Practices Rule. So basically, it is a clarification in many ways to the current National Organic Standard revolving around livestock production, and the most sort of contentious rules, or you know, as part of this, or say the most hotly debated, is that for egg production. So, interestingly, the rules has actually laid out production standards that are very, very similar to what we're already doing. But unfortunately, it's not what everyone in organic egg production is doing at this time. I will say the majority of organic egg producers are following the rule currently, or very close to it, but in a small minority is not. So it's, you know, USDA put the rule, the organic rule, through in 2002, and has, you know, really done kind of very little to modify it. And I think they realized that there was a gap around animal welfare standards. Again, egg production being, I guess, the most glaring. So we do actually have sort of competitors, and there are organic egg farms out there that look very much like the aviary platforms that I've described before, and the hens really don't get outside, or they may get outside onto a tiny little porch, but it's really kind of a token outside space, if you will. So it's, you know, organic eggs being produced on an incredibly industrial scale. There's one farm in the Midwest, northern Midwest, that has close to 2 million hens, organic hens, in one place, and the barns are right next to each other. Hens never go outside on the ground. And then there's another one in Kansas, I believe, that has nearly 1 million, sort of very similar arrangement using these aviary systems. So it's, you know, however anyone feels about animal welfare and what's right or wrong, I think the National Organic Program and, you know, the rulemaking process, the National Organic Standards Board, and all the comments and everything that's been, you know, part of this, have really evaluated consumer expectations. Consumers, you know, expect to go on an organic farm and see a farm that they would recognize, you know, and that's, and welfare for the livestock and for the animals is so important in that. So we're hopeful that this rule will go through. It's sort of being delayed. It should have gone through 2 months ago. The administration isn't particularly friendly, you know, to it is our perception, but hopefully that's not necessarily the case. Hopefully they'll let it go through. And I think it's going to be for the betterment of not just organic egg-laying hens and other types of livestock, but I think the betterment of the National Organic Seal. Again, you know, what consumers expect, and we certainly don't want them feeling like they were duped or betrayed by USDA Organic. That's the worst thing that could happen for all types of food that are certified organic.
Well, you know, in fact, I came across your company in a very positive way, a very positive light, when I did an earlier podcast with a writer with the Washington Post who was talking about this issue as far as dairy cattle, and they had been focusing on a dairy operation in Colorado where it didn't seem like cows were really getting out to pasture, and to the extent. And then when I started talking to him about places that there are some good stories, your farm came up. So you should feel good that you've got an excellent reputation. The word is getting out. And so as these changes take place and the standards get a little tighter, you're not having to worry about trying to reach up to meet those standards. You're already in that space. And that leads me to one nearly final question, Jesse, and that is, you're getting other farms in started. I mean, people that may want to be in the business, and you're helping them achieve getting into that business. Could you explain that, how that works? What's your relationship with these other farms that are producing eggs for Pete and Jerry's?
Sure. Oh, they appreciate the opportunity to talk about that, because working with family farms, it's on a very personal level for me, I guess I'll say, and it's really kind of born out of our history, which I touched on a little bit. But you know, we were a conventional egg farm for many years, but around the time that I was making the choice to come back or not, we were making a transition. And what I didn't say was that it really wasn't a transition by choice necessarily at the time, although it was certainly the best choice we ever could have made. But we were really being forced out of agriculture. We were being forced out of the egg business, and not for any reason other than we were too small. My parents were really, really, really good farmers. Sometimes off the charts farmers, how well their hens would lay eggs, but they just didn't have the scale to compete, and when I say compete, you know, not even necessarily on price, but even just being able to service the very large customers, which that sort of became all there was very large customers. So they were facing a difficult decision of going out of farming, folding up and closing down before bankruptcy. But they, they made the choice, while I was in high school, college at the time, to experiment with organic. And organic unequivocally, literally, saved our family farm. There's no other way to put it. Organic saved our business. So when I came back, we were still sort of hanging on by our fingernails, but it was growing, and it's been growing rapidly. We built a few barns to keep up with it, and I realized at that point that maybe the growth wasn't going to stop, and that was a good thing. We wanted to keep growing to make sure that we wouldn't relive what we had gone through before. We needed to keep growing, but we didn't want to become a factory farm. It was so counter to who we were and the image that we were putting out to our customers, our consumers, really, as to what we were, because we felt very early on that they valued, us on that personal level, I guess, that we were relatable, as a family farm and a family operation. So, again, coming to a crossroads, rather than build more barns, we started looking for farmers, and we found farmers who were a lot like my parents, and in many respects, and one of those respects being that they just want to be farmers. Typically, they're not particularly interested in processing eggs or delivering eggs or really knowing what's going on in the supermarket industry and so forth. They just want to be farmers, and those early farmers, we call them partners in this. Started to be our growth, and it's really continued and sort of snowballed, where we now have well over 100 family farms in 13 states in our supply network, and we've actually shrunk the size of our farm deliberately, the home farm, because we want our supply to come from these family farms. It's become really the mission of the company and the foundation of the brand. That we are a platform for small family farms in egg farming to thrive, not just survive, but actually thrive. And we are them, and they are us, in terms of what the consumers see in the brand. Other than the excitement of growing a business and all the challenges, the idea of providing an opportunity for these family farms and changing agriculture and doing something right, really makes this business worthwhile and this farm worthwhile for me.
Well, that's a great story. How many states have Pete and Jerry's eggs for sale, that people could find them in retail stores?
we are getting close to all 50, but I think it's probably about 47 at this point.
Really?
47. Yeah. Not every retailer, but we're getting close.
That's one of the places that you need to bring your reading glasses when you go to the egg section of the store anymore, because there's the choices. There are a lot of different choices, and many of them have labels describing their system, and you have to look closely to see whether or not they're cage free or whether they're range free or organic. But at least maybe it's what I'm running into a lot in this part of California that I live. There's several different companies. So when people pick up that box of eggs and look at it, any suggestions other than, I'm sure you're going to say that they should look for Pete and Jerry's, and I wouldn't argue with that. But what else would they look for? Is there anything that they have to kind of scratch their head and say, wait a minute, this isn't what I'm looking for? Because I'm sure you've seen all the different ways that the packages of eggs are described, the cartons of eggs are described. What advice do you have to consumers when they find themselves facing the egg case?
Sure. So I'm an organic person. I truly believe in what organic is and what it can do. So that was sort of my first and foremost is look for that USDA organic seal. If you can afford it, it's look for that. But then beyond that, it's the terms, free range specifically, that we use. It's really the only term that has any definition when it comes to welfare in the egg case that USDA has actually described. Now, that being said, it's a loose description, unfortunately. So hopefully they'll tighten that up at some point. So my next piece of advice would be look for a third-party certification that you feel you can trust. And my advice would be Certified Humane. I think it's the Humane Farm Animal Care. So again, Temple Grandin, and she's actually on their scientific advisory committee and helped develop a lot of the standards they use. It's really, really well respected. It's probably the most successful and sort of prevalent standard for livestock in the country at this time. I believe they have the most egg-laying hens on the program. So that's really kind of an assurance for consumers that, the farms are inspected and there's a baseline of sound animal welfare practices on that farm. Organic, free-range, and then a third-party certification for welfare.
Well, that's good advice. And I suppose if people want more information about Pete and Jerry's, they go to your website, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we have a lot there, farmer profiles, and hopefully learn a lot about us.
Now, it's just Pete and Jerry's without any spaces and .com. Is that the website
Correct.
Address?
Yeah. And it's Jerry with a G.
Jerry's with the and a Y at the end.
Correct. My dad's a Gerard.
Okay. Well, and then, Jesse, I just have one final question, and that is, with all we're describing here and what you're involved with in Pete and Jerry's, when you look ahead at being a farmer, what do you find to be optimistic about over the next 4 or 5 years in front of us now?
I find there's a ton to be optimistic about. There's so much to be optimistic about, and leading that is consumers. They want to know. They care. They care for the first time in such a long time, where their food comes from and how it's produced. And they can learn now. So, that is what makes it exciting. They're going to challenge us. They're going to make us better. And they're going to hold us accountable, all of us, in agriculture. And they're going to change things for the better. And part of that caring is a willingness to prioritize the budget. And not everybody can, but for those who can, and for those who do care now, spend a little more on your food, spend a little more on your eggs, because you trust where they came from and how they were produced, and that is what makes all these improvements in animal welfare and how food is produced possible.
Well, you're making me think that if I were asked right now, I'd say one of the things that makes me optimistic is that we have farmers like Jesse LaFlamme and companies like Pete and Jerry's that are taking these steps. I really appreciate your taking the time to share your story with us on Farm to Table Talk, Jesse.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.